Okay, thank you. So what I wanted to do is give you an overview of both the facilities and the science that we're undertaking at Snow Lab. So this, this is a little bit superficial in some sense, so I will subject you to a slideshow of photographs around Snow Lab at some point to give you a feel for the infrastructure that we've got down there. But to set the scene, one of the initial questions is, well, why are people working in underground labs? And so it's obviously driven by the science that we're attempting to answer. And one of the key questions that Snow Lab and other underground labs are looking at is the question of the dark matter, the galactic dark matter that we know exists. It says it's on. Is that working? Well, it's green light on.
The big voice will come on.
Right. So I just wanted to set the scene of underground science and put it in the context of a particular program. And because I worked in dark matter for 15 years, this is the one I've selected. So I'm not going to subject you to stuff that you're well aware of in terms of dark matter and its existence. But just to review that in terms of the stuff we're doing at Snow Lab and in terrestrial underground experiments, what we're interested in looking at is the galactic dark matter in our local environment. Okay, we're building detectors, we're running them in labs here. So you have to be able to demonstrate that dark matter exists in the local environment, basically in our galaxy. And this is still the most striking evidence that we have for that, which is looking at the, basically looking at the velocity of stars as a function of distance from the galactic center. This hasn't come out particularly strongly, but this is the radius from the galactic center against the velocity of the star. And you're using the Doppler shift of any line of light from a star to pick that up. So take a spiral galaxy like our own. All spiral galaxies rotate. That's why they're spiral galaxies. So stars are coming towards us at the top of the board, going into the board at the bottom of the galaxy. You can work out from the Doppler shift how fast they're going. And look at the light, basically look at the velocity distribution across the galactic plane. And what you find is that most of the mass of the galaxy is in some form that you can't visibly see in these sort of photographs. So up to 90%, 80, 90% of the mass of the galaxy is in terms of this halo of dark matter. So the red line here are the points for the velocities measured, and you get what's known as a flat rotation curve right to the edge of the galaxy. So the other way of looking at this is that the stars at the edge of the galaxy are moving so fast that they will basically fly off from the galaxy if you didn't have additional gravitational force holding them in place. This assumes, of course, that gravity acts as we understand it acts on the scale of the galaxy. Similarly, if you look at the Milky Way, our own galaxy, you can plot similar velocity distributions and you find exactly the same thing, that you end up with a flat rotation curve, which tells you there is a significant component of dark matter. So that's the green curve is just hot gas. It's a component that wouldn't be visible in an optical, but you can pick that up from X-ray emission. So there is this is still some of the most fundamental evidence that we have that galactic dark matter exists, and that's what we're really looking for in underground labs. Just to complete the picture, on a larger scale, on galactic cluster scales, you can use gravitational lensing. This is where a lot of work has come in over the last 15 years. And this is really stellar stuff, startling stuff. This used to be my favorite image from the Hubble. So this shows you a deep field shot where every orange point of light in here is a galaxy. These aren't stars, these are galaxies. And you can see these images of a blue galaxy which exists behind this galactic cluster. And what you're seeing there is gravitational lensing in action. So there's a blue galaxy behind there. The light from that blue galaxy is bent by the gravitational effect of this cluster, and you end up with a broken image. So if it was a perfect lens, you would end up with an Einstein ring like this. So these are some other weak lensing measurements that people have done looking at quasars. If you have a sufficiently powerful computer, you can reconstruct the image and say, okay, what's the mass density mapping across this photograph need to be to give me a gravitational lens that would have this effect? And that's what's shown down here. So this is basically an XY scan across that image. And you can see it's actually the density the mass densities. You can see these spikes which relate to the individual galaxies. But underlying that, there is a broad distribution of material that you can't see in this optical photograph, but you know it exists from its gravitational effect. And that's dark matter again. So significant dark matter again at the, you know, the 80-90% level in terms of the mass that we're looking at on this sort of scale. This is where one can ask the question about the relevance of gravity on these sort of scales. And one of the recent works that people have been doing using composite images, so this is a composite image where, again, you're using gravitational lensing to map out the matter distribution, to map out the density of matter across across an image. And that's shown in the blue. This is a false composite, of course, so that's shown in blue here. But you can also look at the X-ray imagery where you work out where the hot gas is, and that's shown in red. And the this is the bullet cluster where you've got two galactic clusters interacting, pass through each other. And what's happened is that the strongly interacting hot gas basically has been retarded in that process, whereas the weakly interacting dark matter has just gone straight through, and you get this separation. So this shows you that there is not a co-located, that where the hot gas is not co-located with where most of the gravitational effect is occurring. And so that's telling you that it's not a simple case that we don't understand gravity. If it was just gravity that we didn't understand, the gravitational lensing would sit on top of the hot gas, but it doesn't. So there's evidence there that certainly on these sort of scales, we do understand the gravitational effect. And then just to complete the picture, I'm sure you're all well aware of this, in terms of the mass of the universe, the problem gets worse. So this is startling cosmology. I mean, when I started in this field, you know, cosmology was, if you got an order of magnitude, then you were happy. And now people talking about several percent cosmology. I mean, it's just startling progress over the last 20, 25 years to get to a point where you can make a statement that you have a concordant model between all of the different observations that people make. And that concordance is that we have no idea what 95% of the universe is. And that's a pretty startling statement to be able to make. And as you're probably aware, as you will be aware, the majority of the universe is in this form of the dark energy, which you guys will understand much better than I do. The matter density is about 27%, but of that, you know, 80% of that matter is in some dark form. And that's the dark matter that we know exists in the galaxy. So at all scales, you're seeing evidence for the dark matter. So that's just the astronomical and cosmological argument that dark matter exists, and it exists on all scales, including our own galaxy. And of course, this is where the particle physicists get interested in these sort of observations. And postulate that through whatever extensions to the standard model, I've just selected Susie here because it's not yet out of the game, I'm told, reminded this morning. There are models beyond the standard model of particle physics which have been constructed to address other issues, so things like the hierarchy problem in particle physics. And they would give really good candidates for dark matter, so you'd end up with weakly interacting massive particles. So this is just a reminder that there is a second stream from the particle physicists where you actually get a particle predicted from theories constructed for a very different reason, which would actually solve the dark matter problem. And I think it's that cross-linkage and synergy that many of us found extremely compelling, sufficiently compelling to dedicate our life to. So from the experimentalist, what does that actually mean? So you can construct experiments to look for these WIMPs, for the weakly interacting massive particles. But what it means is that you have a very low rate. And we now know that the sort of event rate that we're looking for can go down to, you know, events per ton per year sort of scales. So that's an extremely low interaction rate that you're looking for. Because it's a kinematic reaction, so the concept is that you're building your dark matter detector underground, you're basically just sweeping through the dark matter halo, and it's a kinematic interaction of your of the nuclei in your detector with the dark matter halo that you're looking for. You can trivially work out the energy deposition is very small, so it's only a few tens of keV that get deposited into your detector. And you know, through whatever detection technique, that may be less when it gets converted to an observed signal. It also has a similar exponential background to many, a similar exponential shape, just because it is kinematic. It's got a similar exponential shape to many backgrounds. And this makes it a tough experimental challenge to make sure that you can think about, well, when we do get a signal, how do we know we're just not looking at a, you know, a thermal background coming into a photomultiplier tube or something like that in your detector system? So they're the challenges, and what that means is that your technique needs to be extremely low background. So obviously this is radioactive background. So you need to worry about gammas and betas from radio impurities in your detectors. You need to worry about neutrons also from those radio impurities, but also from cosmic ray muon spallation. So there's a significant neutron flux from cosmic ray muon spallation in surface facilities, in shallow facilities, that you have to shield yourself from through a variety of different routes. The detection principle needs to be low threshold so that you're picking up this small energy deposition in your detector to maximize the spectrum. And what you're really looking for, or most detection techniques are looking for, some mechanism to discriminate the nuclear recoils that we expect from the WIMPs and the electron recoils that you get from the gamma and beta backgrounds. So there needs to be, so what you're aiming to do is develop a discriminating detector to spot the differences either in, you know, in pulse shape of your scintillation or the relative yield of ionization versus scintillation. Some way to discriminate the background that you're trying to reject. This also feeds into many of the current technologies people are trying to develop have very good position sensitivity. Because if you have good position sensitivity, you can start to exclude backgrounds coming in from components in your detector. You can actually see where you have a hot spot and remove that. You can start looking at the ability to discriminate these very exotic backgrounds that people are now beginning to pick up, where initially you might not think about multiple interactions in your detector. You need to be able to separate those as you go down into lower and lower cross-section reach. So position sensitivity becomes another input that you're looking for. And ultimately, to reach, you know, significant cross-sections like 10 to the minus 10 or even lower, you're going to have to build ton-scale, multi-ton-scale detectors. And that's going to cost a shed load of cash. Right? So it's going to be it's got to be a significantly large detector to be able to pick up these low cross sections. So if we look at the background side of things, obviously we're underground. The reason to go underground, trivially, is to get away from the cosmic ray muons. So I just give you a handle. I mean, there's a muon going through your hand every second when you're on the surface. Okay, and that's just the canonical cosmic ray flux. As I mentioned, they can generate, they can interact in your detector directly, but more importantly for dark matter systems especially, they can spallate neutrons from local material, and that would get into your detector system and mimic the signal you're looking for. So you want to get deep underground to get away from the cosmic ray muon flux. It also does reduce the cosmic ray gamma flux as well. And this is not necessarily important for dark matter searches, but an area that a lot of underground facilities are beginning to look at seriously is deep underground nuclear astrophysics. So there is one facility already running an accelerator, so the Gran Sasso lab is running an accelerator doing nuclear astrophysics where you're looking at very low cross-section measurements that you can't reach on the surface because you've got, you know, MeV gammas in the cosmic ray flux that mask the signal. So by going underground, you're getting away from the cosmic rays primarily, but also you are reducing the backgrounds. They have an underground accelerator which needs to be very stable because you're beginning to push down the threshold looking at can't remember what the exact reaction that the Holy Grail is, but it's one of the carbon burning. So that there, it's the nuclear physics in the stellar process that you need to refine. And the surface measurements that people have been able to do so far, you haven't been able to have the threshold to get down sufficiently far to be able to probe those reactions. You're just masked on the surface. So obviously we go underground in Snow Lab, just to locate you. Snow Lab is Northern Ontario, just above Lake Huron. So this is the Sudbury region where Snow Lab is located. We're 2 kilometers underground, actually on the 6,800 feet level. It's an operating mine. It's operated by Vale, so it's a nickel mine. And this just shows you the standard muon flux as a function of depth that you go down, showing the Snow Lab, Sudbury, has about 10 to the 6 reduction, basically. So that one a second going through your hand goes down to one a month, basically, when you're down in Snow Lab. And that reduction obviously gets rid of the muon flux. It also affects the neutron backgrounds, as I was saying. So you've got neutron production from cosmic ray muon spallation. But that's not the only issue for neutrons. Uranium and thorium, obviously you have neutrons from fission. You also have alpha-N reactions from uranium thorium isotopes, either in the rock or in your detector. So although going deep is one component, it's not the only solution to get rid of the neutrons that you have to worry about in dark matter systems. So what's shown here are a couple of, these are simulations actually, comparing the situation in two different labs. One is Modane, so this is the Fréjus road tunnel going between France and Italy. And the other is actually a salt mine. This is the Bulby salt mine. It's a potash mine, but the lab is in the salt layer, the sodium chloride layer. And the point of this simulation is just to remind you that depth is extremely important in knocking down the muons, clearly. It's extremely important in knocking down one of the neutron components. But neutrons are prevalent from other aspects. So what you see here is the neutron flux for Modane and the neutron flux for Bulby. You can't actually make out particularly easily, but they are on the same scale. And they're effectively equivalent. And that's because although Modane is at a much greater depth, the Bulby mine is in rock salt, which has very low uranium and thorium. So you have a much lower fission and alpha-N generated neutrons. So the different energies, of course, to the muon spallated neutrons, but you do get a reduction in that, which means that you have to look at the local environment. That's really the point I'm making. You have to look at the local environment of each lab to understand the background extremely well. So
do you know if there's any experimental verification of any of those curves?
Well, this is these are measurements. From these, I'd need to cross-check. I mean, Bulby, yes, neutron measurements have been done there. The ASPRA program, before I left Europe, the ASPRA program had a program of somebody going around to each of the labs with a neutron monitor looking at the spectrums, but that would have been higher energy spectrums in the various labs. I'm not sure what happened with that. So these are observations from LNGS and the Modane lab. So again, you can see that the local geology is making significant effect, especially down at the thermal energies. I mean, you're beginning to see significant differences. The issue depends not just on what the uranium thorium concentration, but also the concentration of moderators that you have in the local environment. And this is relevant, for instance, where one of the dark matter signatures that people look for is annual modulation. And if you look at the amount of moderator in the walls of your facility from summer to winter, if you're in a road tunnel, there's a difference. During the winter, there's a lot more water, there's a lot more moderator in there. That affects the thermal neutron flux quite significantly. That's not actually the answer to the Dharma issue, before anybody asked me that. But yeah, it's an indication that to understand the signals in these underground facilities, you really have to understand the environment extremely well. And that means understanding all of these sort of quirks. Small levels of high neutron cross-section elements inside your material make a big difference. So you've got to look at the chemical composition, not just the radio impurities in the lab. Okay, the same is true for gamma backgrounds that you have to worry about. Obviously, the uranium and thorium for contamination levels. So this shows you the gamma spectrum measured in three different labs. So again, it's Grand Sasso and Bulby and the surface. And basically, what you're seeing here is the red line is Bulby, and that's in a rock salt. So that's low in uranium and thorium. And that gives you low gamma activity below the 3 MeV. Above 3 MeV, you're dominated on the surface by the cosmic ray gammas. Going underground knocks that down significantly. So you can see the suppression there. And this is the region where the nuclear astrophysicists are interested in picking up these reactions. So that's why going underground is important for them. So below 3.5 MeV, the spectrum is dependent on the local geology and the rock material. So what I'm really trying to stress here is that depth isn't everything. Depth is essential to get rid of the muons. You know, there's no other way to do that. You can tag the muons, but if you want to get rid of the backgrounds from muons, you've got to go deep. But even then, you still have to understand your geology very carefully. It's not as good as salt. It's a hard rock, so uranium and thorium is relatively high. So one of my ambitions is to basically end up with a full characterization of all of the labs on a common footing, right? And you know, we are working towards that so that you will end up with an understanding. You know, as an example, our radon is actually higher than some of the other facilities because we are underground in a hard rock mine. So our ventilation flow is not as strong as some of the other road tunnels, for instance. So we have higher, we have elevated radon compared to that. But all that means is that you just have to scrub, you know, use old air when you're in a when you're working on a detector component that's important, or cover it or whatever. So you need to know that though before you build your detector underground, because the radon characteristics affects how you manage your system. Obviously, in terms of depth, we're the deepest, so the high energy spallated neutrons, which are going to be the killer for dark matter searches eventually, you just need to go deep, and so you have to contend with these other issues at some level. So ultimately, I'll come to this later, of course, but CDMS are currently working in the Sudan mine in northern Minnesota. That's too shallow for the next generation because they'll see high energy punch through neutrons from cosmic rays, spallated neutrons coming through their shield, which what they won't be able to tag, because their muon veto is not sufficiently robust. Right? So they won't be able to see these neutrons coming in. It's not sufficiently inclusive. So they have to go deep. And it's that balancing, I think, which the labs do need to get a little better at working together, making sure that we're putting the right experiments in the right location. That's probably too altruistic for words, but... Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, I mean the point of the last few slides was demonstrate there are significant backgrounds, not just from depth, right? And you have to go through the process of when you put an experiment into a facility, understanding what those backgrounds are, and mitigating them appropriately. So this is just showing you the sort of level that people go to, making sure that you can understand your background. So this is a simulated snow plus energy spectrum. This is actually an interesting example where one of the background snow plus needs to contend with is carbon-13, which is cosmogenically generated. And so if you look at a similar plot from something like Boroxino, which is also a liquid scintillator detector, but at a lot shallower depth, their carbon-13 signature begins to mask the signal that they're looking for. It's actually a neutrinoless double beta decay experiment. So going deep in that case is to get away from the cosmogenic activation of the detector. Yeah.
Energies. Would snow blast be? Can you go down the threshold so much? I mean, here it starts from zero. That one.
Well, this is the two neutrino background. That's the neutrino less. That's the two neutrino, and this is the. I think that's the carbon, right?
There's all at least in Boroxino. There's a large carbon 14.
Okay, maybe it's 14 I'm thinking of then. Okay, that's the cosmogenically activated carbon 14.
No, it's actually a contamination.
It's
contaminated.
Okay,
don't know
no.
Where it comes from.
Okay, then I don't know the answer from the Snow Plus perspective, but the plant that is being put together, if carbon 14 is in there, I don't see how they would be able to get rid of that. So I'm not quite sure what the mitigating strategy would be then.
In Boroxino, the level is at the 10 to the minus 18, but still it's enough to dominate the signal. So it's. Do you know what would be the threshold of snow plus?
No, not offhand. Well, they're getting down to the PP line, so come to that in a bit. Okay, so you want to go deep, you want to suppress your backgrounds. So what I wanted to do is just update you as well on the status around the world of several of the facilities to demonstrate that there are a lot of these facilities being developed and exploited, and this is a traditional Google map. So the green points are ones which are proposed. The blue and the red points are ones that are primarily operational at the moment. I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was the political leaning of the government, but It might have been. Might have been a funding issue. So what I wanted to just update you on were the expansion plans. So obviously there's a lot of facilities around the world, but some of them are being actively developed. And one of the, just starting in Europe, one of the ones that is currently operational is the Modan lab. So this is in the Fréjus, as I say, the Fréjus road tunnel between Italy and France. And they currently host the NEMO 3 detector. That's being upgraded to Super NEMO. That's a neutrinoless double beta decay target. A significant low background counting facility and the Edelweiss dark matter detector. And their plan is to extend the facility significantly. So this is the existing facility here in the road tunnel, and they're planning to expand that significantly to take the Super NEMO and the Eureka projects. So Super NEMO is a neutrinoless double beta decay upgrade to NEMO. Eureka is the cryogenic dark matter search, which is merging of Edelweiss and CREST. So this is a planned expansion based on the fact that there was a fire in the Fréjus road tunnel several years ago, which shut the tunnel down. And the French and Italian governments agreed that they'll put a safety gallery in, so a second road tunnel. And during the construction of that second road tunnel, they anticipate developing this new facility. So my understanding at the moment is that mining of the safety gallery started from the French side, but not the Italian side. And the funding for the new lab is imminent. It's not yet secured, but it's imminent. And that.
So is this also under the big mountain?
It's next to the existing. I mean, that's the existing Modan lab. So it's going through the French Alps. Yep.
So this is a silly question, but it's something that I never put on that. So when they quote the 4800 MWE, is that measured from directly?
Yes. No? That's vertical depth.
But the result, there are also some flux that come from an angle.
That's right, and that's one of these issues characterizing a lab that you need to be cognizant of. That Gran Sasso is a very good example where, when you're looking at the muon flux in the Gran Sasso lab, it does have some angle dependence because of the mountain. So you have there's an azimuthal effect of the flux, which means that the vertical depth is not the minimal shielding depth. The minimal shielding depth is actually at an angle because you've got the side of the tunnel. So those of us who work in flat overburden sites, which are primarily mines, those of us who work in mines, for us it's easy because the minimum or the depth is the minimum overburden that we have, and then you have a very simple relationship giving you the shielding from that. For mountains, you have to characterize it very carefully. And this does have implication, of course, for things like the Dharma signature, where you're looking at potential modulation as the Earth moves. But yeah, this is a road tunnel. I quite like the concept, though, here that the French have started mining and going to just keep going through to Italy, irrespective of what happens. Invade with a tunnel boring machine. So the largest underground facility is Gran Sasso, which is in the Gran Sasso mountain range in Italy. So this has been running for 20, 30 odd years. Very strong program of research. And although they're not expanding, what they are doing is they're refreshing their program continually. So although there aren't any dedicated expansion plans here, they are looking at evolving the process. So Hall B, for instance, there is a space that's opened up here between Warp and Icarus, and that's where the Xenon 1 ton detector is targeted to go. So this is the Gran Sasso Science Program, very strong. Focus on dark matter neutrino. They obviously do have a beam line coming from CERN. So a lot of fuss recently about superluminal neutrinos being observed in the Opera detector. So although they are not expanding Gran Sasso, they are continually refreshing the available space and making space available for new projects. A somewhat different approach is taken by the Japanese. This shows you the Kamioka mine, where Super K and Kamioka were sited. The approach here is when a new experiment gets funding, they just dig another cavity and host it in that cavity. So recent new experimental halls have been constructed for XMAS, which is a single-phase liquid xenon, primarily dark matter and solar neutrino detector. So a new cavity has been constructed, put together there. New lines put open for demonstrator, a gravitational wave interferometer. So this is a deep underground gravitational wave interferometer there. The advantage is you're getting away from the 10 hertz background that you have on the surface just from population effects. So, there are obviously seismic effects in Japan. What a stupid statement, right? it doesn't harm you in the sense that when you go deep underground, the frequency response of seismicity changes. So the low frequency that they're trying to evade, the 10 hertz frequency, that's the sort of frequency range that you have from seismic activity on the surface. So when you're designing a building on the surface, you have to worry about the slow evolution, right? So that's why people, when the building skyscrapers have damping systems, you know, a big pendulum in the skyscraper. Underground, you have much more high frequency impactive. So there's very different characteristics. So that in terms of what they're looking for here, it won't, you know, obviously having a seismic event affects the interferometer because it's going to knock it out. But in terms of the high frequency, low frequency, they're still not going to be seeing them. Okay, so a new lab been opened up in the Kamioka mine. A relatively new introduction to the deep underground facility bases in China. So this is a hydroelectric plant. So the river runs around. So it's the Jinping mountain range. The river runs around and has something like a 300 meter drop. So they've put water tunnels through here, access tunnels and water tunnels through here to generate hydroelectric power. And at the same time, in the middle of that, they have generated a small facility. So this is now formally, if this comes back to our question about overburden, the vertical overburden here is 2.5 kilometers. So this is formally the deepest lab in the world at the moment. And it was put together extremely rapidly. So this is a few shots around the facility that they've developed there. So it's relatively small scale. There were expansion plans that they had in place to make a much larger facility, but they didn't get into the current five-year plan. So they're going to go back in, well, whatever it is, 3-4 years to get back into the next five-year plan to see if they can make a greater expansion to the facility. So their program is primarily looking at germanium detectors, small-scale germanium detectors for dark matter searches. And then to close out the new labs, there is a plan in South America, and this has direct relevance for the dark matter searches using annual modulation. So there is a plan in South America to put a road tunnel between Argentina and Chile. And in the middle of this goes through the Andes. In the middle of this road tunnel, there is a plan to put a deep underground facility. So this has a lot of support from the South American research community, not just Chile, not just Argentina, but the whole of South America is interested in developing this. The road tunnel is a strategic issue. If you're looking at trade from Brazil going westward, at the moment it's got to come down around the Cape. Or go over the roads over the Andes. And the roads over the Andes are open, you know, like 2 days a year or something ridiculous, right? It's a very difficult path. Going around the Cape is a very slow and arduous journey. So for the Brazilians who have one of the most developing economies at the moment, they're looking at ways to exploit that economy out west, and this then makes this a strategic asset. So this tunnel is probably going to happen. And with the support that the people are giving to the lab, I would anticipate this lab coming online. So this would then be a deep underground lab in the Southern Hemisphere. And the interest from the dark matter community is that all of the, if you're looking for annual modulation, at the moment, all of the facilities are in the Northern Hemisphere. So the summer-winter effect, if you have any, if you have, you know, temperature cycling, if there's any climate issues associated with summer winter, you would now have a facility where you would have an antiphase with what you're looking for. So you'll be able to take if you're running two detectors in, one in the Southern Hemisphere, one in the Northern Hemisphere, and you saw a correlated antiphase, then you know that it's to do with the climate, not the dark matter signature. So quite a lot of interest from people generally to develop this.
They should aim a neutrino beam there.
We'll add that to the list. We'll add that to the list. Yeah. Okay, so coming to North America, just a reminder that the US, there is the underground lab in Sudan, which currently hosts the Minos beam. So this is a beam line from Fermilab to the Sudan mine where the Minos detector is. The current plan is, I believe, to continue operation of Minos, right? So I think that's now in the pipeline. So Sudan will continue. It's also the site currently for the CDMS and Super CDMS first stage detectors. It is shallow. You know, it's only 700 meter deep, so it's not a significantly deep underground facility, and that for dark matter experiments is going to be a problem. So the US are looking at alternative sites, and the site that's been selected for their underground facility is the home state gold mine, which was the original site in which Ray Davis did his chlorine solar neutrino experiments. This was a gold mine. The gold mine was shut down several years ago and flooded for several years, for two or three years, before the decision was made to use this as the prime site for the deep underground, for the US deep underground program. So since that point, they've been developing the infrastructure there. It was originally under the moniker DUSL, the Deep Underground Science and Engineering Lab. That name is no longer used now because that was the name that NSF gave it, and NSF pulled funding from the project. So DOE are now calling it the Sanford Underground Research Laboratory Facility, or SURF. So the changes that have happened are that the focus now is on the 4850 level at Homestake. And this will be for a long baseline target from Fermilab, coupled with other modules for developing dark matter and double beta decay experiments. So just a couple of slides from them showing the location. So this hasn't come out particularly well. But this is the 4850 level campus. So this is a Walter Cherenkov design of the long baseline target, which is now not current because they're going with liquid argon. That decision was made 2 weeks ago. This just shows you the Walter Cherenkov design with a dark matter and double beta decay lab module shown here. So they are continuing to develop the infrastructure there for their initial science program, which is the LUX dark matter detector, which is a liquid xenon system, and the Majorana demonstrator, which is a germanium-based double beta decay, neutrinoless double beta decay target. So that is ongoing, but it's a continued dialogue in the US about whether or not they need or whether or not they want an underground lab at Homestake. And I think we are certainly supporting that from Snow Lab to try and develop a very strong North American program. South Dakota, yeah. So, okay, that's just a whirlwind look around the labs around the world. But what I'm trying to put across is that this is a well developed field, but it's still expanding. I mean, there are expansions underway in many sites. So that just gives you an idea of the scale of the expansions that people are looking at the moment. So. Yeah, the DUSL was going to be the largest, and if the Walter Cherenkov is developed, which doesn't look likely now, as I say, if the Walter Cherenkov is developed, then it obviously would be the largest underground site.
Isn't there one in Korea as well?
There is. That's the Yangyang. Yeah, that's under construction.
So there are also very deep mines.
Yeah. It would be, I think, going that deep, there would still be advantage to that. I mean, I've got a slide on that right at the end about when is deep enough. So going deeper makes sense at some point when you're trying to, if the community needs a lab at a greater depth, then certainly people are going to be looking at things like these minefields. I mean, the coal field in India was used as well. The point of an underground facility, though, is it's not just a hole in the ground. There's a whole infrastructure around having an underground lab and making it accessible, and I think that's where you find a lot of the focus here is making sure for Homestake, for Snow Lab, you know, you can deploy experiments there. It's not just here's a hole in the ground, do what you like with it. And I think the development of that infrastructure, certainly South Africa, would be, you know, would be great in that area. But it doesn't exist at the moment. It's not being done at the moment.
What's the difference in Dusa and Susa?
Yes, this is a little old. So Susul is the current campus. Dusul is the expansion. So now, I don't know how I'm meant to phrase it. Susul is surf, and Dusul is also surf. Maybe it's surf one and surf two. I don't know. Okay, so what I'm really here to tell you about is Snow Lab, right? Having shown you that it's, yeah, that you need underground space for these sort of science programs, that there are developing infrastructures around the world, what are we doing here in Canada? So Snow Lab, as I mentioned, it's operated in the, it's an active nickel mine operated by Vale in the Crichton mine near Sudbury. It's developed from the existing snow detector. So Snow was a solar neutrino, the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory. It was a solar neutrino detector, solved one of the key issues about the flavor transformation. Our underground campus is at 6,800 feet, which is a quarter of a muon per square meter per day, different units. One of the characteristics of Snow Lab that is unique is that we operate the entire lab at class 2000 clean room or better. So the intent here is that we're controlling the materials and the people that come into our facility at a single access point so that we know that we're not introducing contamination. Let me put a marker on it. If you threw a gram of mine dust into the snow detector, you had just skewered the physics. Right? So a gram of mine dust, think about the amount of dust in your hair when you go for a walk in a mine. Right? It's quite easy to generate that amount of dust. So we have to control the amount of contamination that comes into the facility. And the mechanism that we're using is to control it at a single access point so that we know that when you get into Snow Lab, you're not going to contaminate your own experiment. And more importantly, you're not going to contaminate somebody else's experiment. The focus is on large-scale kiloton size detectors, dark matter double beta decay, and solar and supernova neutrino experiments. And we've tried to progressively create space for people to deploy experiments even as we've been constructing it. So,
is there any discussion of gravitational wave detection in Snow Lab?
No, we're an active mine, so I think that will be difficult to. So the politics side of things, the Snow Lab was $65 million construction cost, and we're operating at the moment about $7 to $8 million with 60 operational staff. So this is a joint federal and provincial funding, primarily through the CFI from the federal side. So the CFI provided most of the infrastructure funds. And the operational funds is, as I say, it's a joint. So we are fully supported to 2013 and are actively, obviously, seeking funding from that point onwards for the operations. In terms of the current status, the surface facility has been operational from 2005. It provides, you know, sort of things you'd expect: offices, conference room, showers, changing rooms, warehousing. We do have a 400 square meter class 1000 clean room. So the intent there is that if you want to do development work or put an experiment together on the surface before it gets shipped underground, there is space to do that. The underground construction added 5000 square meters to the snow area. We have two additional large cavities, named the cube hole and the cryopit, and a bunch of supporting drifts. And it just gives you the layout of the various areas. I'll just show you a map in a minute. It's easier. We started excavation in 2007, completed in 2008, and basically integrated the whole area into the clean room last year. So Snow Lab is now operational. And we've transited from this period of constructing Snow Lab, turning it into a clean room, putting things in, into the phase of putting experiments in and developing developing the infrastructure. So the it's a shot of the surface facilities. For anyone who visited Snow, they're the original sea containers at the back. And the blue building at the back here is the heavy water containment. So that's where the $300 million worth of heavy water went through when it was going down into Snow. We don't have a canteen like you guys do, unfortunately. Underground, the expansion of 5,000 square meters has introduced this new area here. So the original Snow detector was put into a cavity here. Snow is still the largest cavity at this depth. And this was the original utility drift, the original personnel area. So the clean room entry point was there. We've now pushed that back to here. So this is the clean room entry point here. These are the new personnel facilities and the new experimental halls up here. So that's just an access ramp which runs back down to the bottom. So we have two large cavities, the cupel, the cryopit, and then a whole bunch of drifts into which we can put a variety of different experiments. So to give you a run through the various areas, this is outside in the mine. So here you see typical people in mine clothing, typical state. This is actually shotcrete, so this is concrete that's blown onto the wall. So you can't see the secondary support. There's a rock bolt poking through. But you can't see the majority of the secondary support on here. But you can clearly see the amount of dust and junk that you have to worry about as contamination coming into the experiment. So it's a 1 megawatt cooling plant. So we have 5 chiller systems which are used to cool the facility. A significant amount of the power use that we have goes in cooling the area. Clearly, every watt of power that you put in, you have to take out. And that includes people. Right? We have to contend with, I think it's about a kilowatt of heating from the thermal input as well. So there's quite a bit of heat coming in from the rock, quite a bit of heat coming in from people and so on that you've got to take out. So we have a megawatt of cooling capability. This is the entryway into the facility. Here you get a really good idea of what the standard mine environment looks like. So we have fairly heavy meshing here to hold down any loose that comes from the side. But it is an active mine, and that means that you have pressure pulses coming through from the mining environment. I mean, people are taking nickel out of here. So they are doing blasting. They are doing significant amount of work, not close to us, but sufficiently close that we will get pressure pulses coming through. So we have to contend with that. We're also very deep, and when you go deep, you do get seismic activity from rock bursts. So you have to contend with things up to factor 3 on the Richter scale, something of that order, just from rock bursts, from de-stressing of the local environment. So in this sort of environment, it's not necessarily the chunks that are coming off, it's the dust that you, if you get a pressure pulse coming through, it can shake the rock and you get a lot of dust coming off. So that's the sort of thing that we have to worry about. So going through into Snow Lab, this is the clean entry point. So it's a multiple cleaning stage. These are just hoses to wash down your boots before you go in. So personnel go down on the left. Materials brought in on tram cars, so we have our own, basically our own train underground used to bring in materials. Stuff gets washed out here, taken through the double doors there. So bringing materials in, this is the transformation from outside to inside. So we have two airlocks, dirt locks really. Red floor means it's a somewhat dirty environment. The grey floor means it's into the clean room itself. So materials brought in, washed down, brought in here, washed down again, and then brought into the clean room. What you see is a transition to the internal Snow Lab design, where this is shotcrete. We now put 4 to 6 inches of concrete on the wall and then troweled down the wall and then put a heavy paint layer on there to give us a very smooth surface, so dirt won't adhere to that. It's very easy to clean down, and that's how we can maintain the cleanliness. Same is true for people. So everybody comes in, gets showered, and this is where the politicians tend to balk at this point. Yeah. Okay, get naked, get in there, yeah, wash your hair. Yeah. The cameras only come out at the end of the politician's tour when we bring out the checkbook and say, okay, yeah, you want to get out? We're scoped for about 120 people in the facility, so that gives you the scale. Now, this is the galley refuge, so this is yeah, this is our galley, this is our kitchen area. In one of the health and safety meetings that we hold every week. So this gives you the sort of scale, and this limits the number of people that we can have underground. So in an emergency, the approach in North America is basically to get everybody into a safe haven, lock the door, bolt the doors, make sure the gas tight. So if there's any, if there's a fire or something like that, an evolution of gas, you're not going to cause problems for people. So we have a compressed air line. It's this one up here. This compressed air line comes down from the surface, bringing fresh air in. You know, we have this. This is the best refuge on the planet because it has flush toilets, it has a microwave oven, it's got coffee machines, it's got internet access. Yeah. If you're going to be stuck underground, this is the place to be stuck for a couple of hours, right? So in the event of an incident underground, everybody just retreats here and waits until the issue is cleared. The only real times that people have had to go in here are on drills or when the cage goes down. So if the winding engine goes out for any reason, there's a technical issue. They don't want people doing work because if they do then have an accident, there's no way to get them out. So in those situations, they tell people to down tools and get in the refuge and drink coffee. So yeah, when the cage goes down, I'm paying my team to drink coffee. That's fine. To show that physicists can learn things as well, the design of this refuge is significantly enhanced from the snow days when the toilets were on the outside of the door. So yeah, You'd go into the refuge, you'd get the kettle on, you know, three cups of coffee later, you know, that's a mistake. So anyway, we have learned. There's a small meeting room, so this is the world's deepest astronomy lecture underway. I'm not using the world's deepest often enough, right? We have the world's deepest flush toilets, we have the world's deepest. This is the world's deepest astronomy lecture underway, fully networked. So they're the sort of ancillary systems. In terms of the business end, this shows you the cryopit, which is the smaller of our cavities, so the third largest space at this depth. This is looking down from the top, so you're looking down 50 feet to the floor. So that gives you the sort of scale that you've got in this area. I have another. So you're looking down into a cavity where we anticipate in the end putting a second generation dark matter or a second generation double beta decay target. And then you would end up filling up this whole cavity with water and putting the detector in. In the cube hall, we have been developing infrastructure for the deep and mini clean detectors. And this shows you... got some additional shots later. This just shows you the sort of infrastructure that we're putting in. So this is all being deployed down a shaft through the mine system. And give you an idea of the sort of things that you can take underground very easily. We had to split these columns in half to get them down through the shaft, not because we couldn't get them down the cage or down the shaft itself, but it's getting it around the corners on the way from the shaft to SnowLab. So you need to think about, you know, when you're deploying these systems, it's building a ship in a bottle in a bottle. So there's a sequence that one needs to work through. But obviously, you know, with Snow and SnowLab, we've been deploying significant infrastructure. One of the benefits to running the whole lab as a clean room, which I hadn't really appreciated until we started doing this, is that it gives you the option and the capability to do R&D very easily. So if somebody's developing a dark matter system and they want to test whether their technology is working and has the legs for a larger system, it can be deployed into a clean room very straightforwardly. And they then don't have to build their own infrastructure for the clean room. And that's a significant cost saving to the experiment. So as an example, this is the Ku detector. It's a Ku 4-kilogram chamber. And it came down, you know, within basically a month or 2 months of them picking up the phone saying, we finished at Fermilab, we want to go to Snow Lab, how about it? Because they didn't have to think about the infrastructure for a clean room operation for a test, this is a test basically, even though it has set dark matter limits now, you know, they could easily deploy that. So operating as a clean room has additional cost, but as far as the experiments go, it has significant benefit. And this is the Picasso detector showing. When these detectors are running, they don't look great, right? It's just a pile of shielding. But inside there, I'll show you what the projects are at the moment. So that's the.
You need to add some flickering lights on the outside of the boxes. Yeah.
Absolutely. You got to look at the other business end, unfortunately. So that's the Snow Lab program as currently conceived. So we actually have had one project finished, which was called PUP. So that was a seismic array looking at this issue about the correlation between an underground seismic activity and surface. So they had a sensor array throughout the mine, including the surface. And once they'd seen a major event, they left. But you can see there is a significant focus on the dark matter and neutrino side. So let me run through in a little bit more detail the science program. And I can't go through the Snow Lab science program without commenting that the final snow results are now out. So this is the analysis of the three phases. So snow was a heavy water detector, a kiloton of heavy water, looking at solar neutrinos, looking at the elastic charge and neutral current interactions from the neutrinos. They had three ways of looking at the neutral current interactions, either looking at interactions on the deuterium, the chlorine, and by direct observation using neutral current detectors. So these were helium-3 detectors, basically. And the final combined analysis is now out from all three phases. So someone was asking today about the result. So it's, okay, so it's 3.5%. It's the boron-8 flux limitation. So that's now the end of snow, basically. The current program, the focus saying on dark matter and neutrinoless double beta decay. In neutrinoless double beta decay, we have snow plus, which is the upgrade to snow. So the heavy water has been replaced with a liquid scintillator. It's an LAB-based liquid scintillator doped with neodymium 150. So although liquid scintillator isn't high resolution, you have high statistical accuracy because there's such a lot of it. The problem from an engineering perspective is that you're replacing a kiloton of heavy water sinking in water. So there's basically 100 tons of downward force. You're replacing that with a kiloton of scintillator, which is buoyant in water. So you're going from 100 tons downwards to 140 tons upwards on the acrylic vessel. So we've had to engineer a hold-down rope system so that we can deploy that over the acrylic vessel and tie this detector to the floor so when it gets filled with scintillator, it doesn't work its way through the deck. We have to replace the hold up ropes because we're moving from a situation in snow where we're looking at relatively high interactions, high energy interactions. In snow plus, we're looking at low energy. And the ropes are actually loaded with potassium. So the potassium 40, the 1.4 MeV gamma from the potassium 40 would swamp some of the signatures that they're looking for in snow plus. So the hold up ropes have had to be replaced as well. replacing liquid scintillator, the heavy water plant with a liquid scintillator purification system. So that's what we're currently involved in. Over the next 2 days, we have a review at the end of which I hope I can go to Valet, the operating company, and say, okay, we're going to take a kiloton of combustible material underground and we're going to boil it, but don't worry, I know what we're doing. Fear not. So this has been underway basically for a few years. Full funding turned on the fall of 2010. So it's been really moving forward since then. The other project we have is EXO. This is a xenon double beta decay where you're looking at the xenon to barium. The Canadian groups in EXO are looking primarily at the EXO gas phase, where you're looking at a high-pressure gas target and trying to tag the barium daughter. SnowPlus also does other neutrinos, so it can pick up the PEP line, it can do GN neutrinos, supernova bursts. But we have a dedicated supernova watch experiment. So this reuses the NCDs from Snow, reuses lead from a chalk river detector, and that is underway at the moment. So we're anticipating, well, that's actually slipped by 3 months, so we're anticipating full operation this spring. And that forms part of the SNOOS array. So where are we with Snow Plus? So there are several sequences in terms of changing these ropes. So the whole down rope net was procured now on site, and it was installed actually last weekend, basically. So that's in. And the hold up ropes are in the process of being installed. One of the issues I mentioned radon earlier, one of the issues is that we have to sand the inside of the AV to get rid of the radon daughters. The amount of radon that we have in Snow Lab, if we expose the acrylic vessel to air for more than 8 hours, then you get a buildup of radon daughters, which again will mask the signature you're looking for. So there is a process to sand the entire AV and coat it to make sure that we can then remove those radon daughters. The electronics upgrade's complete and we're aiming for a water fill by mid-2012. So just a couple of shots of the developments for Snow Plus. This is the bottom of the cavity, and this is before the anchor points were put in for the hold down rope. Clearly, this work required us to drill holes in rock, and so one of the concerns there is you're generating a lot of dust. How do you make sure the dust doesn't get onto the detector? So the way you do that is you drill holes inside these garages, and you cover the whole area with an umbrella structure like that. And then you run it in such a way that the air is always being fed into there. So you're running these at low pressure to contain the dust within there. And we successfully achieved that. In terms of the process plant, this is mining in a clean room. You can't believe how difficult that is. So that's building a bigger pit for the process plant. A bit of a time-lapse sequence. So this is now with the hold-down anchors in place, and with the floor lining re-sprayed on the top. So even things like the floor lining, putting that in, you're generating cyanide gas in that process. They don't make it easy. Snow Plus ropes going in. So this is over the weekend and last week. So this is the hold down net being installed. So these are the lead ropes, the legs going down, and then these are the hold up ropes being replaced. So this is 60 feet up in the air that he's standing at the moment. So this is the photomultiplier support structure in the original 10,000 photomultipliers.
I should have a little picture of a boy holding a
billy button. Yep. On EXO Gas, the gas program is moving to a device where you're trying to extract the barium ion from the high-pressure gas into a low-pressure region and then using electroluminescence. A test cell is under construction at Carlton, and that will be deployed to Snow Lab later. And then finally on HALO, this shows you the shot this morning of HALO. So this is the lead stack here, the green stuff. There are four, you can't quite make them out, but there are four NCDs inserted into each of these holes. And the intent is this is going to be a long-term program. Obviously, we're waiting for a supernova. That's what this does. It waits for a supernova. This will be shielded. So one of the things that is missing, these are shelving units around the outside for water shielding. And then there is a plan to put graphite on the internal surface to reflect neutrons back into the target, but also to keep them out. So you can use rock as a target for these sort of detectors. You could use the rock directly, but to try and get a clean signature, because you're looking for the various interactions in lead, to get a clean signature, they want to just shield the detector and then use the lead. Okay, so that's the neutrino program. In the dark matter program, we have three main thrusts. Noble liquids, this is the deep and mini-clean detectors. They're single-phase liquid argon using pole-shaped discrimination. So deep one is a 7-kilogram target just to demonstrate that you can get 10 to the 9 discrimination between nuclear and electron recoils. And you need that level of discrimination to run the 3.6-ton deep 3600 so that you're then able to separate out the nuclear recoils from dark matter and the rest of the gamma background. Now, argon has a particular problem that argon-39 is a beta emitter, and you get a 20 or 40 kV gamma coming off that process. There is also a program to look at developing an enriched source of argon, and this is one that includes the whole argon community around the world to try and reduce the level of argon-39. So construction's underway. I'll just show you a few photographs in a minute. The other thrust is the superheated liquid bubble chamber technology. So this is Picasso and Ku. So Picasso superheated droplet detectors, and the approach there is that you have superheated droplets held in a gel. You get a nuclear recoil that it changes the criticality, it explodes, and you listen to it. Ku is a bubble chamber, effectively similar sort of technology, where you're operating as a bubble chamber under a critical state, and then you're looking at the bubbles and listening to the creation of them. These are threshold-operated systems operated in a mode, and this is their great advantage, where they're actually insensitive to minimum ionizing particles. So you're only looking at nuclear recoils. You're only looking at nuclear recoils or alphas. And then the final program is Super CDMS, which is the state-of-the-art germanium systems. So it's currently running in Sudan, and when Sudan becomes when the signature becomes masked because Sudan is too shallow, they will relocate to Snowland. So this is another shot of the cupel, gives you a better perspective. So this is the deep 3600 shielding tank. So we're shielding most of the detectors with ultra pure water, which again comes from the snow phase, the plant. So deep 3600 will sit in this tank. Mini clean will sit in this tank. The detectors themselves are under construction. This shows the deep 3600 is an acrylic vessel filled with liquid argon, and this is the first part of the cast underway here. This is a demonstration that you can bond the acrylic and use it in a cryogenic mode, because this is something nobody's ever done before, is take an acrylic vessel and fill it with a cryogen. So although we've built large acrylic vessels for snow, we've never done this with a liquid cryogen inside. And so this is a 20-inch test vessel built at Alberta, and it's designed such that the bonds here, you'll see this hexagonal structure, the length of the bond is the same as the length of the bond in the deep 3600. It's just on a compact detector. It's going to get filled up with liquid argon, cold cycled, and make sure that those bonds sustain through several cycling. So we know we're not going to shatter the acrylic. And then Mini Clean uses a different approach, still liquid argon, but it's a traditional stainless steel approach, and that's the stainless steel internal vessel being constructed. Okay, we talked about Picasso. So this is the J-drift, as I mentioned. That's the coup detector. And just to give you an illustration, this is the 4 kilogram coup test cell. So this is CF3I. And you can pick up these bubbles here. That's a neutron scattering. You know it's a neutron because it multiply scatters. So this is from one of the test runs that the calibration runs. So one of the significant crossovers from Picasso to Coup was the introduction of piezoelectric sensors to listen to the formation of these bubbles. And in this sort of technology, you can tell the difference between an alpha interaction and a nuclear recoil from the sound. So you're actually, a lot of energy goes in at the start of an alpha, whereas the nuclear recoil and the neutrons are a little bit more dribbly. And so you can actually tell the difference between an alphas and the nuclear recoils from listening to these things. So that's an absolutely breakthrough technology for these detectors, because one of the holding items for these systems was, sure, you can run them in a gamma blind mode, but you're crippled by the alphas because you can't get rid of them. Now you can get rid of them. So that's an absolutely breakthrough technology. Oops, what's in there? It's 2 liters. So, yeah, that sort of scale. So there's a 60 kilogram version of this. This is what's being deployed this spring. So just wrap up with the current situation for the results on dark matter, going back to the very start. So Picasso and Ku have both presented new results in the Munich conference last summer. So the world leading spin dependent on the proton at least limit. So this is the Picasso result coming in at 2011, and this is the Ku result coming down here. So you can see the comparison to the indirect searches there as well. Okay, so yeah, we have got some results already coming out from the Snow Lab projects that have been deployed. The sample result, this green dotted line here, that's a reanalysis which many people have trouble believing. In terms of the spin independent limits, this is the current state of the art. There's a lot of activity in the low mass region here. There's potential observations from Dharma, from CREST off the oxygen. If you interpret or overinterpret the CDMS2 events as being a real signature, you can also get it to fit here. And more recently, the cogent modulated signal would also fall into that region. So there's a lot of activity in this low mass region at the moment. The more traditional A squared, you know, the large mass target, this is the current state where it's just a plethora of detectors coming down, reaching into the, well, that's the old SUSY space, I think. Okay, so that's our current program. I just wanted to come back to a point somebody made earlier about, you know, when is deep enough. And this is the plot I showed originally of the muon flux as a function of depth. Except here it's mapped against what we know about the muon flux from all the detectors worldwide. And you see it plateaus out. So this is where you're beginning to get as many upward muons as downward muons. And the upward muons are from the neutrinos on the other side of the Earth. So you can see that should the community require additional shielding, so should you be getting to the Generation 3 detectors and you're not swamped by neutrinos, right, and you need that additional shielding, we still have significant depth that we can exploit. It's a challenge for the labs, right, because when you get down to that sort of level, the stresses become really significant. But you know, there are facilities available. Snow Lab, we know that the ore body at Snow Lab goes down to at least 12,000 feet. No, this is an angle dependent. So yeah, a lot of this comes from snow just by looking at the effective overburden and the muon flux as a function of angle, of azimuth, as you go down. So we know at Snow Lab, for instance, the ore body goes down to 12,000 feet. It gets richer as it goes down, and Vale are interested in exploiting that. So it is possible to conceive in a decade that if the community needs this depth, yeah, we could actually provide it. Challenge, but not insurmountable. Okay, so let me finish just by showing you, yeah, this is my summary slide in effect. Now, this is SnowLab, and we're filling it with detectors. There is one unallocated large-scale cavity at the moment. So if you or your mates have a great idea for a detector to fill up this cavity, give me a call. Thank you.